This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 27th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24, in association with Squarespace. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. First up, I'll be investigating the modernist roots of the corporate logo, with a man who's just edited a vast new compendium on the subject with German publisher Taschen.
This designer is the head of vision, and I think modernism helped them to simplify that vision.
Then we'll be looking at the most ubiquitous but often unseen of modern-day tools, the Photoshop software package, as it celebrates its 25 years of existence. We'll be asking what impact it's had on graphic design and photography.
There are kinds of ways in which these kinds of circulation of images with the tools allow people to critique society in interesting ways.
Plus, a visit to the pioneering urban design studio Wayward in East London, and we meet two accessory designers behind a fresh new fashion brand. All that to come, and plenty more besides, right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Choosing a company logo may seem like a trivial affair compared with other aspects of setting up a business, but a new book charting the development of such designs reveals that there's more to this decision than meets the eye. The beautifully bound book is the work of editor Julius Weidemann and publisher Taschen, and the painstakingly assembled collection charts the development of corporate identities between 1940 and 1980. Drawing on some 6,000 examples, Weidemann looks at how the logos of companies, from media firm CBS to typewriter maker Olivetti, have helped define modernism through graphic design and create corporate identity as we know it. Julius Weidemann visited the studio a little earlier, and I sat down with him to find out a little bit more about the coffee table threateningly heavy new book.
The starting point here is quite interesting. So I have published a number of books on logo design and brand identity and so on. I received an email one day from this student. He's an MA student in Germany. This guy, he said, you know, I'm doing my thesis here. My professor actually asked me to contact someone to talk to because the material I have apparently could be put into a book. When I looked through these things the first time, I said, oh my God. So I forwarded to the guy working with me. And I said, Daniel, this is like really pretty amazing stuff. I mean, it's very rare to find someone that will have the criteria and will take the time to do the kind of research that he had done already. So the book is almost like you look at something, it's okay, 80% is done. It's taken some time after that to put the book together because you start, okay, how do you want to organize the material and the ideas that are generated in the process? That was pretty much the beginning.
So much of how these books come about is the kind of curatorial process. I suppose it's about as much what you've left out as what you've included. But maybe you could tell me a little bit about why this period is so interesting, the 1940s to the 1980s. What were the big changes and what were the things that you tried to that you really tried to bring out in the book?
What you said about leaving stuff out, I mean, it always says that's the painful part of, especially as an editor, you know, when working with an author, you said, oh, you know, we have to go a little bit down with the amount of material. But in this case, this book had a point for this very deep and vast collection. Companies started to become so international in the beginning of the last century. And to roll out plans in other countries for the products that they wanted to sell, they needed to have a consistent image for all the products that they have, product lines, variations of products. So if you have a shampoo, now you have a conditioner, now you have a cream and all these things. We associate these things as being very contemporary, but actually that started in the beginning of the last century. And that became a major part of business after the Second World War. And that is represented in the book. When you look at the selection, and there's so much stuff from the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and a lot in the 80s, it's also because of that. So that is reflected directly in the selection.
There's clearly so much to talk about, from the idea that, you know, businesses are enacting some of the threads of modernism that graphic designers had kind of laid down before. But of those 6,000 logos, I mean, I know it's a hard job, but I'm going to ask you if you can identify one or two that you think really sum up the mood of their day or that were very important in moving the art form forward.
I think we even tried to put that a little bit on the cover. I think CBS is one of these classic cases, and I think it's a case for a number of reasons. The designer, even though he's not so well known, he was almost like an advertising guy in those days. So, you know, he would be as recognized as, and people would pay a lot of money just to hear him talking about how the brand identity should develop. And these designers, they had the vision. And I think modernism helped them to simplify that vision as well. It was not something, it had to be structured. And I think when we think about modernism, and from Le Corbusier to, you know, other things, structure is really a main part of that. A lot of those logos, they are part of that structure.
From the 1940s, when we get these first kind of inklings of how important logos are going to be for companies and how, you know, widely spread they're going to become because of the success of these companies, you know, how does the sort of role of the logo change over time? In the 80s, are you looking for the same things that you were in the 70s and 60s? Or is there an increasing kind of subtlety? Is there a new way of using logos that develops as the time frame develops?
In the beginning, what happened with brand identity and with logos is that consistency was the first thing that people thought about. The structure was really like the grid. You know, this modernism is so much about the grid. Over time, what happened is that these companies expanded so much and they had so many areas of interest that it was important for these logos to become flexible as well. So some parts of brand identity, for example, like color, that you would have like one major color. Later, other companies said, okay, no, actually, we should be allowed to use any color we want as much as we keep some other identity. Olivetti was very forward-looking in that sense. You know, they created a grid that allowed for the use of different colors, for example, when people wanted to have just one corporate color.
Could you tell us a bit about the logo?
It's this Italian company doing typewriters. So typewriters started to become electric typewriters and become more efficient and so on. So this is pre-computer era. And their products start to expand dramatically all over the world. They feel the need to be in so many markets. They can't allow themselves to restrict. So they see very early that the product line is going to expand. So they say, it's not that we do typewriters. Maybe we're going to do many other things very soon. So it's basically a typography with some elements of color. So it's this beautiful, rounded Olivetti written in there that you can recognize from very far. Mm-hmm. And a few elements. And those elements could incorporate a number of colors. Another maybe classic example that deconstructed the logo and allowed it for a lot of flexibility is the Dutch Telecom, for example. It comes much later. When it comes much later, and I mean like the 80s, you see how Olivetti was just so ahead of everyone thinking about that. And that's, I think, what modernism brought, is this idea that you think about a structure but will have to last.
That was Julius Weidemann, the editor of Logo Modernism, a new book by Taschen that's out now. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. This year marks the 25th birthday of Photoshop, Adobe's ubiquitous and groundbreaking picture editing software. Since its launch, the program has revolutionized the way we produce and consume images. Last Saturday, the Photographers' Gallery in London hosted a party to celebrate the program's achievements to date. Katerina Sluis is the curator of digital programs at the Photographers' Gallery, and Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan met up with her to learn more about Photoshop and its impact on the industry.
Photoshop traces its roots back to brothers Thomas and John Knoll, who were studying at the University of Michigan in the 1990s, and Thomas decided that writing a program that could make grayscale images appear on a black and white monitor might be fun. And he had a brother who was called John, who was working with Industrial Light and Magic, which was a sort of early computer graphics visualization special effects company, and they turned it into an image processing program. It was originally called Display, and the Knoll brothers basically pitched it to Adobe in 1988, and Adobe acquired the program and released version 1 in 1990, approximately 25 years ago.
When it was released, was it immediately embraced by the photographic community, or did it take a while for it to warm up to them?
From what I understand, Adobe actually thought it wouldn't be that popular, only sell 500 copies a month. But of course, it became a huge moneymaker for them. And initially, the interesting thing about Photoshop for photographers is it completely mimicked the tools of the darkroom on the computer. So you have the dodge and burn tools. Instead of a darkroom, you have a software interface. And really, it was just high-end photographic dilettantes who kind of got their hands on the kit. But now it's ubiquitous. It's very popular. And to Photoshop is not really associated with the program, but it's just a thing you do with images. It's like cut-and-paste culture.
Katrina, you're a photography professional. I wonder, how has Photoshop changed the industry of photography from the perspective of people who are making images?
The problem is that because you can fix everything in post-production, you can get away with being a terrible photographer. And I've heard many retouchers complain about working with photographers who rely on them to transform images into beautiful, wonderful, impossible images. It's also a crazy art, the art of retouching. I recently got a retoucher to come and speak to my photography students, and they were amazed at the hundreds of different layers that were created to create this composite, amazing, beautiful, perfect image. So there is a really interesting level of labor around the image. We always think of things as digitally as being easy to produce, I'll just throw that together. But there's a real artistry that's emerged around the use of these tools and transforming images. One interesting fact I heard about the kind of proliferation of cut and paste and compositing in contemporary image making is that it's almost impossible to find a photographer who can photograph a car these days. Because nowadays, instead of sending a photographer to the Namibian desert for a week with a huge budget and a car to shoot there, budgets are so low now that you'll get a stock photograph and the car will be sent to you as a 3D rendering. It won't even be made and it will be just dropped into the image. And this, of course, means that there's no need for the very specific tools and skills of professional photographers who know how to light things properly, because that can all be done through the software. So this is a really interesting shift that's going on in the production of images. In front of an audience, Rainer Usserman from Happy Finish showed some of their composite images, and the audience was profoundly shocked that most of the images, product photography in particular, that they see in magazines are completely synthetic and completely composite images. On the other hand, the Photoshop has created and fed into all sorts of internet cultures online. And if we think about protests just through Photoshop and meme culture, I think there was the great example of the meme that spread of a policeman pepper spraying some peaceful university protesters, and then everyone photoshopped that police into different environments as a kind of protest against the violence. So there are kinds of ways in which these kinds of circulation of images with the tools allow people to critique society in interesting ways.
That was the curator of digital programs at the Photographers' Gallery, Katrina Sluis, speaking to Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan about the 25th anniversary of Adobe Photoshop. Coming up on the show, we meet a bag design connoisseur as she pushes ahead with her new brand. Plus, we visit the studio of lauded London urban design firm Wayward. All that to come on Section D with me, Josh Fennett.
Great design tells stories, and Squarespace's innovative website building tool is the perfect platform from which to tell them beautifully. Showcase your creativity, ideas, and business in style with Squarespace's unrivaled range of online products and services. To see how it could work for you and for a 10% discount, head to squarespace.com and enter the promotion code Monocle. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Now, serious bag fanciers will remember Emma Hill and Georgia Fendley from their stints as creative and brand directors at British bagmaker Mulberry. For their new label, Hill & Friends, though, the pair has decided to design bags that nod to the playful side of the fashion industry. Launched in September, Hill & Friends take a strict line when it comes to ensuring English craftsmanship, but one that embraces lively colours and tongue-in-cheek detailing. co-founder Georgia Fendley spoke to Monocle's Chiara Rimella about how important lightheartedness and teamwork are to the new venture and the big plans this newly established brand already has for the future.
I think we're an interesting pair. So Emma is a fashion designer. She's a fashion designer through and through. Huge amount of experience in New York and in London, working for brands like Marc by Marc, Calvin Klein. So her career is really well documented. I don't come from a fashion background at all. I'm a graphic designer by training. I have an agency called Construct, and Construct is this year 10 years old. So my life has been spent building brands, creating the story of a brand for other people. So it's actually very exciting to do it for myself, to be both creator and client. At Mulberry, I was brand director, so responsible for press, marketing, visual communications, campaigns, shows, retail, and our roles and the way that we work together really mirror that relationship that we had at Mulberry. But I guess that, you know, we are the founders of the business, we're the owners of the business. We can be even freer to express ourselves and to think very creatively about how we bring the brand to life, and that's something that we're really enjoying. Hill & Friends is a brand that will extend beyond accessories, so we have every ambition to move into ready-to-wear and all sorts of other categories. But what the customer that we know really well is the female customer, and that's where we feel really comfortable. We have a brand Marc, which features very, very heavily on the product. It's where we take the name Hill & Friends and we turn it into a smile. The eyes move, so they're a kinetic feature of the bag. So essentially, you've got a smiley face, and on the closure, you wink to lock, and on the padlock, you push the eyes together to open the bag. So you have this kind of subversive little friend carried with you everywhere you go on an otherwise very kind of refined and sophisticated leather bag.
How important is happiness in the design process and for your brand?
It's really important. I think that we're both people who have lots of experience. The fashion industry can sometimes be a tough place to work. We feel that the job that we're doing is one that should be really joyful. We're not saving lives, we're not changing the world, but we are making something that we care passionately about. We care very much about fair trade and our ethics and our principles and creating a positive culture. And we feel that luxury should be something that is a transparent and honest process, so that it's our responsibility to make sure that everything is made thoughtfully. It is a good experience, it's a happy experience for everybody through that manufacturing process, right through to the customer who is kind enough to choose our product and wear it and love it and use it every day. So that concept of fashion that's painful and takes itself very seriously doesn't sit well with us. You know, this is fun, we're very, very lucky to be doing that, and we think that we should express that. We took a tough decision early on that we would make everything in the UK. A lot of people talk about Made in England, but we're the only luxury leather goods handbag maker who's entirely making in the UK. It's not easy to do that. We have an amazing heritage in the UK of leather craft, but sadly a lot of the independent factories have fallen by the wayside. They couldn't compete with European and Asian manufacturing prices. So we thought about that long and hard and made a serious commitment from day one. The quality of the leathers is incredibly important. We're using, in the first season, a combination of soft calf leather. Every bag is lined in calf suede, hair calf, goat, some suedes, and some embossed leathers. If you're a bag geek, then you would pick up on some things that are quite traditional craft skills. I think what's interesting is if you look at the bags, like the Oxblood mini bag there, the curved edge is a trapunto padded detail. That's a really lovely traditional craft skill. Everything being suede lined, the edge painting, the attention to detail. The hardware is 0.4 micron. That's jewellery quality. So that's way above and beyond the quality of most luxury brands. Things like on the chain bag, the chunkier chain, it has a bit of an edge. It's not the kind of, you know, skinny Chanel chain. It's very, very different. And so we love that juxtaposition of traditional craft and luxury with something that feels edgier, more emotional, and more in tune with the things that we're all enjoying now.
How important it is for the brand to have women at its helm and to have a team that consists mainly of women. Does that influence the way that your brand is developing and will develop in the future?
I think it's probably inevitable that it does. What I do think is really interesting is that we're a team of very strong women who work really well together. And I think that probably affects the culture more than we realize. We're all very hands-on. We're really collaborative. We operate probably a bit like a family. We all tend to push each other pretty hard, but also look out for each other too. And that's something that I really enjoy. In the name itself, we wanted to convey the fact that we understand it takes a team to build everything that we create. This is not about one person. And we want everybody to learn a lot, to enjoy the process, and to feel valued and to understand what they've achieved.
That was Georgia Fendley, co-founder of the British bag label Hill & Friends, speaking to Monocle's Chiara Rimella. Now, to end the show, we turn to the world of architecture and urban design. Wayward is a landscaping architecture and art practice based in London, which takes the concept of grassroots design more literally than most, basing, as they do, many of their projects around plants. The studio took part in the London City Lab Summit last week to discuss some of the bigger issues facing urban design today. Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan met with the founding director, Heather Ring, and senior designer Thomas Kendall at their studio in Bethnal Green, East London, to talk about their unique approach to urban design.
We're a practice of landscape architects, architects, and urban growers. And we do a really wide range of projects that range from urban gardens and community spaces to playgrounds to events and experiences.
And also recently we're sort of branching out into the world of fiction as well, which is quite exciting. It's a whole new lease of life for the company too. It's quite exciting.
We can talk about that a bit more detail later, hopefully. Do you want to say a little bit to begin with about your overall approach to design, your design philosophy, if you will?
We develop narrative environments, so we're really interested in bringing stories into spaces and creating experiences that are really participatory, so allowing people, communities to be involved in the making and the running of spaces. We're really interested in not just designing something, but about creating a model for how spaces can be self-sustaining, how business models in terms of how they could run, alternative models of community use, and platforms for participation and experimentation and bringing in as many creative collaborators as possible. So it's never enough for us to just design a space. We really want to produce.
So you'll often find us working with a range of artists, graphic designers, illustrators, video producers, radio people, you know, the whole gamut of creative society, which is very exciting because it also then allows the communities that we engage with to tap in on just as many levels.
Do you want to, both of you, together maybe, give me your top three Wayward projects and explain them a bit, the concepts behind them, what they look like and where they are, in order to give kind of a bit more of a concrete idea about what it is you do?
So one of my particular favourites would probably be Beam Camp in New Hampshire. We just finished that this year and it was a giant water slide made for two. It was built with a summer camp of kids, 100 children, who we'd sort of been engaged with the founders of Beam Camp for the last year. And we sort of had a very collaborative process through design. And then we went out there, we saw them, and we got to engage with the children in the making of it. And then we also got to experience them building it. But at the same time, we got to teach them about using treadle pumps. So we got to have a whole wider narrative about education through water. They were pumping the water from the lake nearby to power the water slide, and then the kids were using it. So there's a great sort of very lively atmosphere around the whole project, from education to design to completion. It was kind of a magical atmosphere created.
So the Urban Physic Garden is definitely one of our babies. It's a project that we developed in 2011, transforming a derelict site in Union Street into this thriving garden that was built by over 200 volunteers, celebrating the healing power of plants and food as medicine with a lot of partnership building, which is a really key part of our practice. So bringing in everyone from King's College and Guy's Hospital to Tate Modern to local community groups. And over 100 events were produced in one summer. It was totally self-initiated, so we had no client. And, you know, our practice did everything from, you know, creating the vision to raising the funds to producing it to designing it to overseeing the build to managing the events. And it was really our first experience of really being able to test what it meant to run a space. And, you know, we had a cafe, we had all of these things, and it was a huge opportunity to learn in this way. So I guess the third project would be a project we just won the commission for in Bearwood, which is in Hampshire, just near Portsmouth. And it was commissioned by Future Cities. And it's a really interesting public art project because it's a new town that's basically developing over, you know, it has a 30-year development plan and it's in its first phase. So there's a real kind of long-term idea of growth of the town. And it's basically being built on the Forest of Bear, which we researched the history and found this really interesting maritime history to the forest. Basically, the oak trees of the forest were used to create some of the most important ships in British history, like the HMS Victory. And we also found that these have to be like 80-year-old trees, and there's, you know, thousands of trees for one ship. And they would basically take chains and basically shape the trees in order to get them to be the hull and the various forms of the ship. So we're developing for Bearwood a living sculpture. This is really slow art. We're creating a steel armature that is going to grow oak trees over 50 years into a 1-to-5 scale model of the whole of the HMS Victory. And these oak trees are going to grow over time. This is alongside this model boat pond. And here's where the community really is starting to, they're going to be building model boats for it and be involved in growing. Kids just picked 700 acorns, which are going to grow into a new forest of oak trees and reforest the area. So it's a great opportunity to basically develop something that's really growing with a new community.
In terms of community engagement, which is a key concept and practice for you, a recurring theme when I'm doing stuff about architecture and about design is the gap between what the general public like and what the architectural and design establishment considers to be good, especially when it comes to publicly visible design and art and, you know, stuff which people can see and they're walking down the street. And I wonder, do members of the public tend to be immediately engaged with your designs and with your projects, or does it take a while for them to warm up to them?
We found it really easy, and I think it's because most of our kind of most prominent public projects have been gardens. And it's just an accessible thing. And plants are something that we've found is so universal, so that because they're not traditional gardens, because they're design driven, because they're experimental, because they're, you know, artistic and have all these collaborations around them, it's very easy for people of all backgrounds to kind of connect with it. It's really easy for people who are hard to reach communities like adolescents to connect with it. And because, you know, we're really, I think, as in terms of community engagement, we're really about developing participatory experiences and getting people involved in the making of it, more so than the traditional divide where there's a community engagement phase, where there's kind of ticking boxes, where, you know, there's like surveys done and there's things. And then traditionally, you know, that's done and then a brief is formed and then the designers get the brief and then they, you know, try to hopefully tick some boxes. For us, we don't really do much in terms of consultation. It's more about kind of opening up opportunities for the community. And sometimes they connect with it right away. Sometimes while it's still, for example, a derelict site, they might have trouble visualizing it. But as it starts to unfold, they get more and more likely to buy into it.
That was Heather Ring and Thomas Kendall of Wayward Urban Design Practice right here in London, talking to Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. We'll be back at the same time next week, and if you missed any of this week's show or just fancy brushing up on our back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes to listen again. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant and put together by Alex Funnell. If you have any comments, queries or suggestions, you can contact the show's producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com. As always, thanks for listening and goodbye.